Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, March 18th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. Start off by taking a look at the weather for today and the rest of the weekend. Today it'll be turning partly sunny, windy though, with a north-northeasterly wind at 20 to 30 miles per hour, a high of 46 and a low of 24. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, high 50, low 27. Saturday, mostly sunny, high 54, low 38. Sunday, partly sunny, windy again, high 63 and a low of 46. Our first story today from the front page of the Gazette is written by Aaron Murphy. Vaccines open to all April 5th. All of age Iowans should be eligible to receive the COVID-19 vaccine starting April 5th, Governor Kim Reynolds said yesterday. Reynolds said as long as the federal government fulfills its projected allotment of vaccine doses to Iowa in the meantime, the state will open eligibility broadly, not just to priority groups. She said, getting vaccinated is the most important thing that each of us can do to ensure that our state's recovery from COVID-19 is both strong and sustainable. We all want life to get back to normal. Reynolds said widespread vaccination is the key to Iowa businesses rebounding, graduation ceremonies being held in person, parishioners fully attending churches, and families reuniting. Reynolds said all these things are possible and soon, but like everything else over this past year, it will depend on all of us doing our part for the greater good. Iowans who will become eligible April 5th should not yet attempt to schedule a vaccination appointment. Reynolds said she will provide another update next week after another conference call with federal officials. As of yesterday afternoon, more than 425,000 have completed getting their COVID-19 vaccinations from Iowa providers, and another 320,000 plus have received the first dose of the vaccine that required two doses, according to state public health data. As supply of this vaccine has been limited since this rollout started in December, the state prioritized different population groups to become eligible to receive the vaccine. It started with healthcare workers and long-term care residents and staff, then expanded to include older Iowans, first responders, teachers and education staff, food processing and manufacturing workers, and correctional facility staff and inmates. Earlier this month, eligibility was expanded to include any adult Iowans with a serious health condition. Roughly 2.1 million Iowans are 18 or older. Moderna and Johnson & Johnson's vaccines are authorized for people ages 18 and up, while Pfizer's has been cleared for those 16 and up. Reynolds and Interim State Public Health Director Kelly Garcia expressed confidence that the state and local public health departments, in conjunction with private health partners, will be prepared for the influx of Iowans hoping to make an appointment starting April 5th. Garcia said the capacity to move more doses is there, and the challenge has been having sufficient supply to distribute. Reynolds said, "We're working on it every day. Every single day." She said the state is constantly working with different partners in the business and nonprofit sectors to expand the distribution of vaccines as more doses become available. A spokeswoman for the Public Health Department in Polk County, which is the state's most populous, said the county, in conjunction with its healthcare partners, has the capacity to vaccinate 50,000 people per week. Spokesperson Nola Alger Davis says, "We are well positioned to administer an increased number of doses in Polk County." An additional 38 cases of the COVID-19 variant were confirmed Wednesday by the state public health department. Infectious disease experts believe this new version of the virus, often called the UK variant because it was first detected there, spreads more rapidly. Early testing indicates the existing COVID-19 vaccines are effective against the new variant. The state public health department encouraged Iowans to get the COVID-19 vaccine as soon as it is available and to continue to practice safe public health behaviors like washing hands, manufacturing a safe public health behavior of 6 feet of social distancing, wearing a face covering in public, and staying home when feeling sick. Also on the front page today is a story written by John Steppy of the Gazette. Owner sees big solar future near Dwayne Arnold. For more than four decades, the name of former Cedar Rapids utility executive, now it could have a new connotation, a massive solar energy project planned for 2023 near the now-idle Dwayne Arnold Energy Center. Owner NextEra Energy of Florida this week laid out plans in a virtual meeting with nearby landowners to build a solar farm that could bring in a $700 million capital investment and about 300 construction jobs. The solar farm is planned across 3,500 acres at and near the now decommissioned nuclear plant in Palo, project manager Kimberly Dickey said in the Tuesday night meeting. It is expected to produce up to 690 megawatts of solar energy, even more than the single-unit nuclear plant generated. When Dwayne Arnold was operating, NextEra said the 615-megawatt facility could generate enough electricity for 600,000 homes. Dickey said, "We're also hoping to accompany that solar project with up to 60 megawatts of AC-coupled batteries." Battery storage allows a company to store energy captured when customer demand is lower to use in peak times. The solar project would create about $41.6 million in tax revenue and result in $50 million in payments to the landowners where it is built. That's according to Dickey and the NextEra website. Dickey said the project, once built and operating, is going to offer immeasurable community benefits. NextEra will negotiate leases with landowners this summer and begin construction next winter. The company's goal is to have the solar farm operational in 2023. In a 2019 article, a Dwayne Arnold plant director told the Gazette that the facility, which employed nearly 600 people, no longer fit in Iowa's energy portfolio that increasingly consisted of wind and solar. The facility, which is Iowa's only nuclear power plant, which began operating 45 years ago, was supported and supposed to be decommissioned at the end of October 2020, but extensive damage to the facility from the August 10th derecho forced NextEra to shut it down early. Spokesman Peter Robbins told the Gazette in August, after conducting a complete assessment of the damage caused by recent severe weather, NextEra Energy Resources has made the decision not to restart the reactor. From the Iowa Today page is a story written by Lee Hermiston of the Gazette. Iowa City Truth and Reconciliation Commission takes a break. Dateline, Iowa City. The Iowa City Council suspended its Truth and Reconciliation Commission for 4 weeks and plans on a joint meeting with the group once vacancies are filled. Following 2 hours of public comment and another hour of council discussion, the council around midnight Wednesday voted 5-2 to suspend the commission until April 15th. During the suspension, the council will seek to replace 3 members who resigned from the commission. Some council members argued 4 weeks was not enough time, while others responded to demands from the public that clear benchmarks be set for the commission's return. Mayor Bruce Teague said, "This grieves me to the core that I, as a black sitting mayor, have come before this council and asked for a suspension. I am totally committed to the change of the TRC." Teague said he still has hopes for the commission, which was formed by the council last year to hear evidence of discrimination and racial injustice and provide opportunities for those impacted to share their stories and express their truths through art, theater, and other avenues. However, Teague said it was evident the commission has developed into this unsafe space with the recent resignations of 3 members. The move comes after a contentious March 4th meeting at the commission in which former chairwoman Royce Ann Porter resigned from her leadership role ahead of a vote of no confidence in the commission's leadership. Former vice chairman Tishalyn Harrington also was voted out. Despite vowing to stay on the commission, Porter resigned in the days following the meeting. She was joined in leaving the group by Harrington, Commissioner Anthony Curran, and Jesse Case, who had been hired by the commission as his facilitator. In their resignation letters, the departing commissioner cited the issue of trying to conduct meetings without clear sets of rules and conduct. Curran wrote, "We, as a governing body, had been designated without rules for governance. This flaw, albeit a mere oversight, shall be detrimental the longer the commission is permitted to operate." Roughly 30 people addressed the council, with many opposed to any suspension. Amel Ali, the new vice chairwoman of the commission, asked the council to give the new leadership a chance to show they could right the ship after a rocky start. She said remaining commission members are communicating more and getting serious and legitimate work done in subcommittees. Members of the Black Voices Project, which includes Porter, asked the council in a letter to dismantle and reform the commission. Without structure from the city council, the commission does not understand the scope of its work or funding available to it. The letter said of Black, Indigenous, and people of color, the commissioners remaining after three resignations in the last week claim to represent the BIPOC community. They do not. The way this commission is approaching its work is causing further division in the community as a whole and within the Black community. The city will accept applications for the new commission members until March 30th and appoint the three new members during its April 6th meeting. Also on the Iowa Today page, a story written by Lee Hermiston of the Gazette, Iowa City Park named after Black Pulitzer winner. Dateline, Iowa City. An Iowa City park has been renamed after James Allen McPherson, the first Black writer to win the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and a longtime faculty member at the Writers' Workshop. The Iowa City Council on Tuesday unanimously voted to rename Creekside Park to James Allen McPherson Park. The renowned author lived in Iowa City and died in 2016 at the age of 72. Iowa City Mayor Bruce Teague said, "I think Mr. McPherson is well-deserving. He was all about community. I think this is a great honor, and I'm so happy the city of Iowa City had the opportunity to vote to name this park after him." According to a New York Times obituary, McPherson was born in Savannah, Georgia on September 16th, 1943. He attended segregated schools and earned his bachelor's degree from Morris Brown College in 1965. After graduating from Harvard Law School, McPherson enrolled at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. McPherson wrote two story collections, Hue and Cry and Elbow Room. He won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1978 for Elbow Room and joined the Writers' Workshop faculty in 1981. That same year, McPherson was among the first 21 recipients of Genius Awards from the MacArthur Foundation. The park renaming was born out of the city's efforts last summer to address the demands of the Black Lives Matter movement. McPherson was specifically mentioned as an individual to be considered for a park name. The city council received 18 emails supporting the McPherson proposal, according to Julie Seidel Johnson, the Parks and Recreation Director. Rogers Green, a small park area in the Longfellow neighborhood where McPherson lived, was initially recommended to be renamed. Other community members called for a larger and more well-known park to honor McPherson, according to Seidel Johnson. The park at 1856 7th Avenue Court is easily viewed from Muscatine Avenue. Renovation work was completed last year, and it now features a new playground shelter, basketball court, and restroom. New signage and a memorial plaque will be installed this summer. On the top stories page is a story written by James Q. Lynch of Cedar Rapids. The Iowa Transportation Commission has approved using nearly $122 million in federal COVID-19 relief funds to make up for lost fuel tax revenue over the past year and to pay for trail development across the state. The Department of Transportation recommended the $121.9 million be allocated according to a similar formula used for the Road Use Tax Fund, with the DOT receiving 47.5%, counties 32.5%, and cities 20%. Using that formula, $55.5 million will go to the Primary Road Fund, $28.6 million to Secondary Road Fund, $23.4 million to the City Street Fund, and $9.4 million to farm-to-market roads. The final $5 million is set aside for a statewide trails program. The DOT's portion of the money will be made available for the Commission to include in its fiscal 2022 revenue forecast as it develops the 2022-26 highway program. That's according to Stuart Anderson, the director of the DOT's Planning, Programming, and Model Division. The federal funds, which were approved in December, will offset lost state revenues and allow the Commission to proceed with its program without reduction, according to Anderson. The Commission may be able to add some work in because of this additional funding. The DOT estimates that through June, there will be about a $50 million reduction in state road funding due to COVID-19, according to Anderson. In an effort to get funds to local jurisdiction faster, the DOT recommended using the federal aid swap policy. It will allow cities and counties to get their share of federal funding from the Primary Road Fund, which would then be reimbursed with federal dollars when those are allocated. For the trail spending, the DOT will solicit applications for trail projects, and the Commission will do a one-time award this summer funding specific projects. Here's a story with local implications, written by Tom Barton, says Grassley hints he'll run again in 2022. Hinting that he will seek another term, U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said he will not be swayed by recent polling that shows a majority of Iowans, including a third of Iowa Republicans, hope he decides not to seek another term in 2022. Grassley said to the Iowa Reporters Wednesday on a weekly conference call, "You don't make a decision to run based upon anything other than taking your work into consideration, taking your family into consideration, and visiting with a lot of Iowans." A new Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll released last week found just 28% of 778 Iowa adults surveyed hope that the 87-year-old decides to seek an eighth term, and 55% said they hope he does not. Another 17% of those surveyed were unsure. Grassley's job approval and favorability number also declined among Iowans to its lowest point in nearly four decades, according to the poll. Of those Iowans polled, 48% said they approved of the way he has handled his job as U.S. Senator. 38% said they disapproved. The approval rating is Grassley's lowest since 1982. Grassley brushed off the poll results, pointing to previous similar polls that showed Iowans were divided over whether longtime former state governor Terry Branstad should seek re-election in 2013. Branstad ended up coasting into an historic sixth term. Asked what his considerations would be if he chose not to run, Grassley said, "If that's a decision I've made, you know it by now. So this is speculation, and I'm not going to speculate about anything." Grassley, who has served in elected office continuously since 1959 when he joined the Iowa legislature, filed a statement of candidacy with the Federal Election Commission for the 2022 election, but declined to say whether he is running. He would be 95 at the end of another term. In February, he said he was several weeks away from announcing his decision, but yesterday reiterated that he would wait until this fall to announce his intentions. Asked about the rising number of children crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, Grassley criticized Joe Biden's support for immigration legislation and the decision to allow people to make legal asylum claims. Grassley said, "We are a very inviting nation when it comes to immigration. We have about 1 million people come every year to this country legally, but we shouldn't invite people to break our laws to come to this country. And when you don't have a secure border, that happens. And we didn't even have a 100% secure border under Trump, but we have a more secure border than what we have now in the last 2 months, and it's creating a terrible problem." Grassley said the, quote, "worst thing is for our government to send a signal that, wait a minute, we aren't quite ready for you yet. But when you are, or when we are, and you are, you can come." On the Insight page today, we have today's Gazette's editorial with the headline, "Bill Shows Impact of Journalism." The editorial says, "With a bitterly divided state legislature, controversial proposals understandably earn the most public attention, but a large share of the bills lawmakers pass each year have overwhelming bipartisan approval. One recent legislative accomplishment is attributable to watchdog journalism. Both legislative chambers last week approved a bill to expand penalties in cases where farm chemicals drift to nearby property. The Senate file allows the state's agriculture regulators to impose fines against private applicators, including farmers, whose pesticides and herbicides end up on neighboring crops, trees, and gardens. Current law only provides for fines against commercial applicators, which is an obvious oversight that has only recently gained widespread attention. Democratic State Senator Kevin Kinney of Oxford, who is a farmer, started looking into the issue after the Gazette asked him about it. Kinney said, "I couldn't believe there was no ability for the Department of Agriculture to be able to have a fine schedule or anything in place." Eric Jordan, an investigative reporter for the Gazette, reported last year on an uptick in damage to soybean crops caused by drifting herbicides, particularly dicamba, an active ingredient in several commonly used weed killers. Complaints of pesticide misuse in Iowa last year surged to 329, the highest level on record, up from 270 the previous year. "It is encouraging to see Iowa's Republicans and Democrats come together to pass common sense legislation that's friendly both to the environment and to the farming industry. Legislative proposals to regulate agriculture and auxiliary sectors usually face long odds in the legislature where farming interests reign supreme." Admittedly, the bill does not represent a radically new approach to agriculture oversight. It simply extends the possibility of a $500 fine to more applicators. "We would like to see the state go further by codifying steeper penalties for bad actors, but the Ag Chemical Bill is a good start. What a few months ago was an overlooked issue frustrating farmers is now on its way to becoming a bipartisan law, thanks in large part to the Gazette's reporting. That's a testament to the power of your local newspaper." And that's today's Gazette editorial. Today's guest editorial is from Molly K. Olson, policy advisor for Families United Action Network of Iowa, and it says, "Shared parenting, best for kids." Politics have been tearing families apart. Few issues can bridge the political divide, but in Cedar Rapids, three generations of women unite in their position in favor of equal shared parenting. Despite their polarizing political views at times, these women agree that when a fit dad is ready, willing, and able to parent, children don't need their mothers any more than they need their fathers. Cedar Rapids grandmother Joan is 83 years old. When she was growing up, single moms were not common. Joan was married and lost her husband to an untimely death while in college, when her son was a few months old. A very strong Czech woman, she persevered. She retired after 40 years teaching first and second grade. All the while, her son Mike grew up without a father. Mike is now 61. He always knew he didn't have what other children had, a father. While his grandfather played an important role in his life, the absence of a father was always noticeable to him. He always expected one day he would be a father. He imagined being a very actively involved father. He knew the value of what he didn't have. He always loved kids, and kids adore him. Then came his daughter, Natalie. Mike cherished every second with his little girl. Her mom was from Iowa, too. Her parents separated when she was about 2 years old. And because of family court, Natalie only saw her dad every other weekend, 4 days per month, as a non-custodial dad. Mike fought for equal parenting time for many years, to no avail in family court. His pleas to be a more fully engaged father were never considered important to the court. Yet there was never any harm to Natalie in her father's care. All too often, fit, loving, and responsible fathers who fight for equal parenting time in court are actually considered uncooperative troublemakers because they aren't content with being an every other weekend dad. Too often, outdated laws artificially and unnecessarily create unwarranted court-forced fatherlessness, or rather, dad-deprived children. Natalie is now 30. When she was 17, Mike met me. For 22 years, I have been educating policymakers about the need to remove the obstacles that prevent both fit parents from being fully and equally involved in the lives of their children after divorce and separation. Without a presumption for parental equality as a starting place in law, family courts too often consider dads to be the less important parent. Judges and policymakers are often misled to believe children need just one home. In fact, credible research is clear. When parents separate, children who spend equal time with each fit parent have the best outcomes, second only to intact families. We are three women who represent opposite politics and three different generations, yet all three of us agree that both fit parents are equally important to children of all ages, and the laws should change to equally protect a child's relationship with both parents. Iowa politicians have a chance to truly reach across the aisle for the sake of children with Senate and House laws. Equal parenting laws are long overdue. Equal parenting promotes the well-being of everyone, mother, father, children, and society. That's today's guest column, written by Molly K. Olson, policy advisor for Families United Action Network of Iowa. We have one community letter today from K. E. Graber of Mount Vernon. K. says, a recent letter to the Gazette suggested, if you get a stimulus check and don't need the money, send it back to the government. The purpose? To punish, insult, and get even with the Democrats for their wastefulness and wanton spending. In other words, make them look foolish. Don't do that. The only people you'll punish are the unfortunate secretaries who open the mail and have to decide where to route your check. Instead, if you really don't need the money, donate it to the places that do need it. The HACAP Food Bank, Trees Forever, your local school foundation, your church, Matthew 25, Mission of Hope, Meals on Wheels, an animal shelter, area colleges, various museums, your hospital, the Nature Center, the History Center, a community library, Theater Cedar Rapids, or the myriad other businesses and human service agencies and places that enrich our lives and respond to physical and mental needs caused by the pandemic and the August 10th ratio. Given to others, and doing good, goodwill, make you far happier than ridiculing and embarrassing the government. That is a letter to the editor, written by K. E. Graber of Mount Vernon. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, March 18th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. And we start off, as usual, with the short notices. But as I say that, there are no short notices today, so we'll get into the obituaries themselves. Maxine A. Drawmeyer, age 95, of Cedar Rapids, died Monday, March 15th at West Ridge Care Center. Services, there'll be private services. The burial will be in Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. The Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of the arrangements. The family would like to extend a special thanks to the staff at West Ridge Care Center and her neighbors, Bruce Ballard, Lynn White, Taylor Sokin, and Nate Meyer and Rachel and Chad Osborne, for all the loving care they gave to Maxine. Gary A. Michalik, age 64, of Cedar Rapids, died Tuesday, March 16th, at the Humboldt Care Center North in Humboldt. Private family services will be held at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family. Daniel Gene Stoll Healy, age 49, of High Shoals, North Carolina, formerly of Belle Plaine, passed away Sunday at her home. Celebration of life is 10:30 Monday morning, March 22nd, at Raybeck Newhouse Funeral Service in Belle Plaine. The celebration will be live streamed through the Funeral Home Facebook page. Burial will take place in Rector Cemetery in Chelsea, Iowa. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Sunday, March 21st, and will continue 1 hour prior to the service Monday at the funeral home. From Cedar Rapids, Beverly Ann Richardson, age 86, died Tuesday, March 16th. Private family mass of Christian burial will be held at St. Pius X Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids, with the Reverend Philip Thompson as celebrant. Interment will be held at Elmwood Cemetery in Washington, Iowa. Public visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, March 19th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids, and masks should be worn at the visitation and the service. John Phipps of Iowa City passed away at home on Monday, March 15th. Private services will be held. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the Hawkeye Area Council or the U of I Dance Marathon. From Omaha, Nebraska, Colette Marie Yarrington died March 15th. A celebration of life service will be held at 1 o'clock Saturday afternoon at John A. Gentleman Mortuaries in Omaha. Mary Elizabeth Sixt Jackson, age 62, of Iowa City, died on March 10th. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, a celebration of life will be held at a later date, with details to be posted when decided. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be sent to the Parkinson's Foundation, the Michael J. Fox Foundation. Emily Beck, age 91, of Marion, passed away Monday, March 15th at St. Luke's Hospice in Cedar Rapids. A celebration of life will take place at a later date. Arrangements by Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in Marion. Janet Patton, age 72, of Lisbon, passed away Tuesday, surrounded by her family at the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics in Iowa City. A private mass of Christian burial will be at 10 a.m. this Saturday at St. John the Baptist Catholic Church in Mount Vernon. Burial will be in St. John the Baptist Catholic Cemetery in Lisbon. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to mass at church. Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon is caring for Janet and her family. Forrest W. Johnson, 100 years of age, of Mechanicsville, died Friday, March the 12th, at home with his family. Visitation will be from 6 to 8 p.m. Friday, March 19th, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services, Mount Vernon. Funeral service will be at 11 o'clock Saturday morning at the funeral home by Pastor Michael and a Gokin. A Masonic service will take place during the funeral. The funeral procession will drive by the Mechanicsville United Methodist Church around 12:30 p.m. on the way to the burial at Rose Hill Cemetery, where guests may show their support to the family. Friends and extended family are invited to watch this service via live stream. You can find that live stream link on Forrest's tribute wall and share your support and memories with the family at the Stuart Baxter Funeral Home website. Due to COVID concerns, the family was unable to proceed with their planned 100th birthday party last year. So instead, Forrest is celebrated by his church and the community with that drive-by parade we mentioned, including fire trucks and more than 75 vehicles. A celebration of life will be scheduled later this year when family and friends may safely travel and attend. Turning our attention now to sports, there's a sports brief having to do with Coe College. Coe's Jared Cruz and Cale Schmidt have been named to the American Rivers Conference first team. Luther's Jaden Torres earned second team honors. Dubuque swept the top honors. Peter Reagan was the MVP. Brock Simon, the Defensive Player of the Year, and Robbie Sieverding, the Coach of the Year. Going back to news on the Iowa Today page, a story written by Rod Boschett of the Gazette, Coralville Lake drowning leads to law. The Iowa Senate Wednesday approved legislation that would make it a crime to fail to disclose the location of a body with the intent to conceal a crime. Democratic Senator Kevin Kinner of Oxford said that the Senate file, approved 47-0, was in response to events following the drowning of Noah Herring at Coralville Lake last spring. The 15-year-old Herring drowned April 7th of last year. Three teens and an adult were present when Noah died, but the Johnson County Sheriff's Office said none of them called 911, and they withheld information about Noah's whereabouts. His body was finally recovered April 11th. At the end of the investigation, the only applicable charges, misdemeanors, related to theft and destruction of property. Those present when Noah drowned didn't face any charges for failing to alert authorities because such charges don't exist. Under the proposed law, which now goes to the Iowa House, anyone who witnesses someone else suffering from imminent danger of death or risk of serious injury and fails to contact authorities would be committing an aggravated misdemeanor. Additionally, if someone abuses a corpse and fails to disclose its location to conceal a crime, he or she would be committing a Class D felony. Kinney said, "This really hits home because it happened in my community. This is a bill about Noah Herring, who passed away. His family came to me and was up in arms about what could be done. We worked through this, and all the Herring family wanted was so this did not happen to another family." Taking a look at today's COVID-19 information, written by Kat Russell of the Gazette, Iowa reports 565 new virus cases. Iowa on Wednesday reported 565 new COVID-19 cases and 9 new confirmed deaths. To date, almost 344,000 Iowans have tested positive for the virus and 5,666 have died since last March. That's according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. Iowa's 7-day average for new cases is 415, the lowest since 401 on July 5th. Of the new cases, 73 were among young people up to the age of 17, bringing the total number of children who have tested positive for the virus to 39,219. As of 1:30 yesterday afternoon, 1.14 million COVID-19 vaccine doses have been distributed in Iowa, with 1.09 of those doses going to Iowa residents. Both totals are up by more than 25,000 from Tuesday. Across the state, just over 425,000 people have been fully vaccinated. Of those, 396,000 plus are Iowans, the equivalent of 16.26% of Iowa's adult population 16 and older, and almost 13% of Iowa's total population. State officials say 394,555 people have completed the Moderna or Pfizer two-shot vaccines, and the remaining individuals, over 30,000, received the single-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine. In Linn County, 84,634 vaccine doses have been administered, with 33,000 plus people fully vaccinated, 18.39% of the county's adult population and 14.63% of the county's total population. In Johnson County, almost 68,000 vaccine doses have been administered. Of those, 23,691 are fully vaccinated, or 21.23% of the county's adult population, and 17.46% of the county's total population. Wednesday's 9 confirmed deaths took place between January 31st and March 13th. 3 of the deaths were of individuals over the age of 80, 3 were between 61 and 80, and 3 were from 41 to 60. Polk and Scott counties reported 2 deaths each. Counties with 1 each were Blackhawk, Fremont, Jackson, Muscatine, Warren, and Winneshiek counties. 1 death that was originally assigned to Delaware County was removed from that county's tally and reassigned to an unspecified county, bringing Wednesday's total to 9. Across the state, COVID-19 hospitalizations dipped slightly from 162 to 161 yesterday. The number of patients in intensive care, though, ticked up from 40 to 41, and patients on ventilators remained at 21. Only one long-term care facility in Iowa, the Vista Woods Care Center in Ottumwa, is reporting an outbreak of three or more cases. 13 people are being treated for the virus there. Since the start of the pandemic, 2,223 people have died from the virus in long-term care facilities. That's 39.2% of the state's death toll. Here's a story written by the Cedar Rapids Gazette as a staff. School board votes to drop Native American mascot. Dateline Comanche. An Eastern Iowa school board has voted to drop the district's Indians nickname and mascot following renewed appeals this year to do so from Native American tribes and organizations. The Comanche Community Schools Board voted 5-1 Monday night to stop use of the mascot by the end of the school year. That's according to television station KWQC. The mascot was adopted in 1961 when the school opened. Comanche Superintendent Thomas Parker said, quite honestly, our school mascot is a stereotype. He said a new mascot was not immediately chosen. The decision comes as teams on all levels across the country are changing or reconsidering mascots considered to be culturally insensitive. The Washington football team of the NFL dropped its Redskins mascot last year, and Major League Baseball's Atlanta Braves have stopped using the Chief Wahoo mascot. The Kansas City Chiefs are under pressure to end the traditional war chant by fans that uses a chopping hand motion designed to mimic the Native American tomahawk. Closer to home, the Marion Independent School District earlier this month decided to postpone a vote on adopting the Mavericks as its new mascot. That move came after the school district last year decided to drop its Indians mascot. In Comanche, most spoke in favor of keeping the mascot during the public forum portion of the meeting, citing pride in the nickname. Some denounced the move as cancel culture, but board member Shane Bark said there has been calls for 30 years for the district to drop the mascot. Bark asked, how are we honoring the Native Americans by ignoring their repeated requests to remove the Indian mascot? On today's Living page, there's a story written by Katie Mills Giorgio, a correspondent for the Gazette, which says CR Restaurant features families' favorite dishes. Some people make New Year's resolutions. And some people, like Brandon Campbell, take on new ventures in the new year. In late January, Campbell, along with his wife Samantha and younger brother Angelo Baker, opened Soul Good Southern Diner on the southwest side of Cedar Rapids. Campbell said of his new restaurant, Soul Good is simply inspired by decades of family recipes, soul, and the love put into preparing traditional African-American and Asian cuisine dishes. Campbell said he and his wife, with her Asian-American background, have brought their ethnic dishes to family gatherings such as Thanksgiving or Chinese New Year celebration for years. Campbell said, we were amazed how these completely different, unique foods were always a hit and conversation starter during these types of intimate family events. So, when the planning stages for their own restaurant took off, this soul food, fried chicken and fish, cornbread dressing, sweet potatoes, egg rolls, and crab rangoons, so familiar to Campbell and his family, seemed like the makings of a tasty menu. Campbell said, it is exciting just being able to bring more inclusivity and diversity with food to our community. I feel we have established a family-oriented atmosphere that our community will love and appreciate. The restaurant industry is not new to Campbell. He said, my parents used to own a similar style restaurant in our hometown of Lovejoy, Illinois. I remember as a kid helping around the restaurant, which I enjoyed. My mother, Valerie, has taught us all the recipes in the Soul Good kitchen. Now Campbell, who moved to the Cedar Rapids area as a teenager, is creating those types of memories with his own family. He said, my favorite part of owning a restaurant is being able to see and work with my family each day. It's been a learning process that has indeed brought us closer as a unit. Since opening Soul Good just about a month ago, Campbell said catfish, collard greens, and mac and cheese have emerged as customer favorites. he said. And our daily specials are driven from the meals I grew up eating, like meatloaf, baked chicken, and my favorite, beef short ribs. Currently, Soul Good is open for dine-in and carry-out, with COVID-19 guidelines being enforced. They will begin offering delivery options soon as well. In the era of COVID-19, Campbell said, it has most definitely made it more challenging to take a risk in opening and ensure we adhere to state and local guidelines to protect our customers, community, and friends. This epidemic is something we do not take lightly, as it challenges us to be international or intentional and conscious of our interactions as a family and with our customers. Nevertheless, I have learned from living in Cedar Rapids that when we come together during difficult times, love, perseverance, and unity help navigate any problem or issue. It is our happy place and where we call home. In a column that is labeled Chew on This is a story about East Coast Sub franchise expanding into the corridor. A new sub sandwich franchise is expanding into the Cedar Rapids metro area. Brian and Lisa Ridge opened a Jersey Mike's sub on November 18th at 6095 Carlson Way in Marion. Now a second shop will open March 24th in Cedar Rapids. The latest franchise shop is owned by Matt Irusha and Ben Sanderson. It will be located in the Fountains retail area at 5240 Edgewood Road Northeast in what used to be Farrell's Extreme Body Shaping. Jersey Mike's is taking over part of that site, and Farrell's moved to a standalone building. Hours will be from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. Irusha and Sanderson both grew up in Cedar Rapids. Irusha attended Xavier High School and Sanderson Prairie High School. They became friends while playing football at UNI. Irusha, who has been a bartender, and Sanderson, a real estate agent, had been hoping to go into business together and had been looking at franchises when they discovered Jersey Mike's. Irusha said, "Everything about it, their values and quality, seemed like a good fit for us." The shop got its start in New Jersey and the East Coast, then spread to the West Coast before starting to make its way to the Midwest. Irusha called it deli style, where the meat is sliced right in front of you. It has both hot and cold subs, but is probably best known for its Philly cheesesteak and chicken cheesesteak subs. Its number one sub is the Italian. Irusha said, "I asked my aunt and uncle, who live on the East Coast, what their favorite place to eat is, and they said, Jersey Mike's, so that really told me something." Irusha and Sanderson started the process of opening the store about a year and a half ago, before the pandemic. Irusha said, "We were really nervous about COVID and the uncertainty of it all, but we just decided you've got to go for it. It did scare us, but it never scared us enough to scare us away." The store will have both carryout and in-store dining with social distancing. Customers can order in advance using their app and pick it up in about 20 minutes. It also has signed up with DoorDash and Grubhub for delivery. Irusha and Sanderson said they are still hiring and expect to employ about 20 people. They also plan on expanding to the Waterloo-Cedar Falls area, but for now they're busy preparing for their grand opening next week. Irusha said he'd like to see the shop break the record of subs sold on opening day, which is 700 giants, and a giant is 15 inches. He says, "It's go time." Here's something that's not often seen in the Gazette. It's a drive talk column, and it's kind of interesting for local drivers. The headline says, "Driving slowly can be as dangerous as speeding." Someone wrote in, "Dear Car Talk, my wife and I have differing opinions on how fast to drive. I think driving 5 miles per hour to 7 miles per hour under a speed limit is not being discourteous to other drivers. I also like to drive slower when approaching a signal. Your column is awesome. I look forward to reading it every week." Ray Magliozzi responds, "Buttering me up won't help you today, but please do try it again in the future. I have to side with your wife," he says. "If you're able to drive at the speed limit and do so safely, that's what you should do. I'd never criticize anyone for driving at the speed limit, even though many people drive faster than that. But I don't recommend being the guy moseying along at 23 in a 30 zone. It is discourteous to drivers behind you, especially on a road where people can't legally or easily pass you. You may be in no hurry whatsoever. but you may be retired, but you may be enjoying the sounds of the birds singing and your wife complaining about your driving. But most people aren't in that situation and get frustrated behind someone who appears to be slowing down traffic on a shared public road for no reason. While it would be nice to live in a world where everybody slows down and enjoys scenery more, in this world, your driving behavior leads to tailgating, road rage, and potentially dangerous behavior in other drivers, like trying to pass you while flipping you the bird at the same time. Those are the studies that show that speed differential leads to collisions on highways. So, if you're going 48 miles an hour and someone else is driving 62, that's a recipe for a crash, regardless of who's right and who's wrong. Now, if you simply feel like you can't drive safely when doing the speed limit, then it's time to reconsider whether you should still be driving at all, and whether it's time to enjoy the passenger seat and let your wife do the driving. I know that's a tough pill to swallow, but it happens to everyone at some point. At least think about it honestly. You don't want to get to the point where your wife is renting a car and meeting you at the supermarket. And that is the Gazette's Car Talk. Here's a story on the Iowa Today page that has some local significance, written by Ron Boschert of the Gazette. Senate goes after big tech as threat to free speech. The Iowa Senate Wednesday approved a bill that would deny high-tech companies future state and local tax breaks if they were found by a court to have illegally stifled speech on certain viewpoints on social media platforms. Senate President Jake Chapman said, "The sad reality is that we have liberal executives in the Silicon Valley dictating what Iowans are going to be fed through social media platforms." The bill, approved on a 30-17 party line vote, could impact hundreds of millions of dollars, more than $1 billion by one senator's estimate, in state and local tax incentives for big tech corporations like Facebook, Google, and Microsoft, if a court finds they have violated the free speech rights of Iowans. Republicans who touted the bill, which now goes to the Iowa House, called it a strike against tyrannical propagandists who must be challenged, given that social media has become the modern town square. Democrats dismissed the measure as a political document that will hurt Iowa's image among businesses and in the world at large. Senator Jim Carlin of Sioux City said, "We have to confront this here and now. Big tech is a real threat to the freedom and future of what America stands for." He told his Senate colleagues, "This handful of people have the wherewithal to silence whoever they please. They have dominion over what we're allowed to see, to hear, to read, the power to tell us what we're allowed to think. No tech CEO in Silicon Valley should have that kind of power." However, Democratic Senator Janet Peterson of Des Moines called the bill an anti-jobs, anti-tech, anti-business, anti-growth measure by radical majority Republicans drunk with power that is giving Iowa's reputation a black eye in the business community and scaring away development projects. "I wish Governor Reynolds would have stepped up to tell you that this bill is bad for business, because now, even if she vetoes the bill, the damage is going to be hard to repair," according to Peterson. Senator Liz Mathis of Hiawatha said the bill takes Iowa to the land of backward thinking and demonstrates delusions of mediocrity. Another bill heading to the Iowa House for consideration is legislation that says Iowans who are victims of assisted reproductive fraud would be able to seek legal damages, and perpetrators would face felony criminal charges under a Fraud and Assisted Reproduction Act. The legislation, which passed 47-0, seeks to address cases where those seeking fertility assistance are instead victims of fraud, specifically cases where the physician represents the sperm donor's identity. And finally, the Senate voted 30-17, again along party lines, to send to the governor's desk legislation that says cities cannot prevent landlords from rejecting potential tenants who use government housing vouchers to pay rent. Before giving final passage, senators approved a House amendment that would move the implementation of that Senate file to January 1, 2023. Ordinances affected by this bill are in effect already in Des Moines, Iowa City, and Marion. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, March 18th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle. So it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies, with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.